Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we are bringing awareness to substance and alcohol use in our youth. Today's youth are constantly bombarded by social media's pervasive influence and allure of harmful substances. There are social media challenges occurring in our community, daring teens and children to take harmful drugs that are readily available to them. Social media is not the only culprit of spreading misinformation about the use of tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, and even over-the-counter medications. They are hearing misinformation from their friends and often not discussing the truths with their parents or other trusted adults. Don't let the wrong information be the only information your child receives. Learn strategies to communicate through conversations that build trust. To help steer the conversation today, we have guest Mr. Joshua Arvidson, licensed clinical social worker and the founder of the Alaska Child Trauma Center and chief operating officer at Alaska Behavioral Health. Also joining us is Ms. Tiffany Hall, executive director of Recover Alaska, an organization working to reduce excessive alcohol use and harms. Mr. Arvidson, Ms. Hall, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. You can also join our conversation. Are you aware of the issues of substance and alcohol use affecting children and adults? Are you aware of different outlets targeting our children to influence them to experiment with the misuse of over-the-counter substances? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, I've really been looking forward to having this conversation. As a mother of a preteen now, this is very scary information that I'm learning with the things that are going around out there. I'm not aware of many of the things that our kids are exposed to, and I think many parents are in that same situation. So I'm hoping today we can figure out how to use this conversation to educate parents, children, teachers, all of those that have influence over our kids. So let's get to know you both a little bit better. And let's start with you, Mr. Arvidson, and tell us how you became involved in this important topic and in social work.
Yeah, so I started graduate training in 1998, so 25 years ago as a licensed clinical social worker. And I wanted to go into the healthcare field. I was particularly interested in behavioral health because it's a field of healthcare where a lot of improvements have been made over the last 20 years, and treatments are getting much more effective. And I just wanted to make a difference in my community. So I chose behavioral health, and I chose clinical social work because it takes a biopsychosocial approach to wellness. Looking at biology and neurobiology as a driver, and then psychology and social and in the social environment and context. And so that really appealed to me. So that's kind of how I got started.
Well, in addition to your work in social work, you're also the founder of the Alaska Child Trauma Center. Can you tell us about this National Child Traumatic Stress Network and the Alaska Child Trauma Center? How did that come about?
Yeah, so so my first job when I came out of graduate school, I moved back. I was born and raised here in Alaska, and I moved back. And I was doing assessments, and I was doing clinical evaluations, mostly for kids and parents who were coming through the child protection system. And that was a pretty incredible job. It was a pretty overwhelming job, too. I sometimes felt like I was standing kind of in a river of trauma. And I saw really two challenges that I just kind of saw on a day-to-day basis. And one of those challenges was access. So I remember days where I would come to, I was part of a little team that could serve a couple hundred kids a year. And I would come to that team, and I'd have 15 kids that needed counseling, and they could take one of them. And I'd have to go back and tell 14 families, we just don't have the care that you want and that you need. And then the other piece that was a big challenge was all these kids were experiencing trauma, and a lot of the treatments available weren't really focused on the underlying trauma. They were focused more on the behaviors and the things that come out of trauma. And so I saw kind of two needs, a need for improved access and improved care. And, you know, it was tough. And I got a call from my wife and she said, it's time. So we wrote a proposal with the team that I work with and that she worked with to start the Child Trauma Center. And that team has taken off and grown. And this year we'll serve 1,500 kids. So those days when I had to tell families, we don't have anything, we don't have what you need. Fortunately, those days are over and I'm determined to make sure those days never come back.
Oh, wonderful. And you're serving children throughout Alaska?
Oh, yeah. We have clinics in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and we just opened a clinic in Wasilla.
Wow. Yeah. So I like that you're serving children and treating not just symptoms, but the root cause.
Yeah. That's really important.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Hall, tell us about your work at Recover Alaska and what led to your interest in this role.
Sure. Recover Alaska is an organization working to reduce excessive alcohol use and harms across the state. And we try to do that at the system level. So we don't provide direct services. We do advocacy and policy work. We try to change social norms around alcohol to reduce stigma and celebrate and honor sobriety. We try to increase access to care, again, from the system level. So just trying to make sure people are aware of what's out there and what structural barriers we might be able to support with. And then also prevention. We operate a statewide network of preventionists, whether that's prevention of violence or suicide, other substances around the state. And I came to this work about 7.5 years ago. I have a background in public administration and had done some policy work and some marketing and some fundraising, but what really drew me to the job is my lived experience as a person in long-term recovery from co-occurring alcohol use and mental health disorders.
Well, I'm sure with your personal experiences, that shapes what you bring to that role.
It definitely does, and I will say at the beginning, I had to sort of get over some imposter syndrome while I was in the room with providers and folks who had studied a lot about the topic, but grew to recognize the real value of lived experience and having been there and having understood what the barriers are and what the stigma feels like. And so trying to really elevate that aspect.
Well, working at the systems level seems like a pretty daunting task.
It is a big job.
Yes. Well, I see you're also on the board of directors for the U.S. Alcohol Policy Alliance. Can you tell us about the work that takes place there?
Sure. It's actually similar, especially, I mean, around the policy work that we do. But we are a national organization. One of the things we're trying to do is to help states establish statewide alliances to do local and state level policy work around alcohol in their states, but then we also address national policy issues. So we are working with folks trying to update the warning labels on alcoholic beverages to include cancer as one of the things that is caused by alcohol. So that's just one example. But as different dietary guidelines get brought up, things like that, we just try to really stay at the forefront of alcohol policy.
How long have you been doing this work?
I started that in the middle of 2020, so I've been on the board for about 3 years now.
That's interesting. Well, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and I recently read that 1 in 4 adults are affected by some form of mental illness each year, and I was also stricken by the fact that death by suicide is the second leading cause of death in young people aged 10 to 34. So today we are discussing substance and alcohol use, but it's clear that behavioral health and mental health are interrelated. So I thought, Mr. Arvidsson, you could define those terms for us and tell us, you know, what is the difference between mental health and behavioral health?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, you know, when I entered the field about 25 years ago, there was kind of a field of substance use and abuse treatment, and then a separate field of mental health treatment. And what we've learned from the science around how humans work and treatment approaches is that when you silo substance use treatment and mental health into two different systems, often you don't meet the needs of individual people. Because mental health conditions and substance abuse disorders, they don't always co-occur, but the rates of co-occurrence are very high. So roughly half the folks who present in a mental health clinic are struggling with substances in some way, and roughly half the folks who present in substance use treatment programs are struggling with a mental health condition. And so the field of behavioral health, the term behavioral health integrates substance use treatment and mental health treatment into more of a an integrated approach to care, where there's really a no wrong door approach to care. So that's what behavioral health has come to mean over the last decade.
So when you're Alaska Behavioral Health,
yeah,
but you are managing behavioral health and mental health issues?
Yeah. So our the depth of our programming in mental health is really robust. We provide kind of every level of care all the way up to, but not including inpatient care on the mental health side. And then we provide co-occurring treatment for folks who have a mental health condition and also struggle with substance use or substance use disorders. We don't provide some of the highest levels of substance use disorder, like a medically managed detox, for example. But we provide behavioral health and that we treat folks with co-occurring conditions.
And you mentioned about 50% of people with behavioral health conditions also have mental health conditions. Are you finding that to be true also for children and adolescents?
It is true for adolescents. It's less true for younger children. They're less likely to have substance use challenges. But it is present in our adolescent population that we treat and our transition age youth population. And it's about half the folks that we see in our adult mental health programming also struggle with substances in some way.
Wow. Yeah. Well, what is the prevalence and impact of substance and alcohol use among children and adolescents in Alaska?
Yeah, so unfortunately, and I know as Alaskans, we're used to hearing some of these things. There's some pretty scary statistics in Alaska in terms of prevalence. Our substance use patterns among children, adolescents, transition age youth, and adults are typically higher than they are in the rest of the country on aggregate. There have been some, you know, changes over the years around substance abuse patterns in our state, and I'm sure we'll get more into that. But Alaska, as a state, has relatively high rates of use and abuse of substances across the age range.
Are the issues more or less prevalent outside of Anchorage?
Yeah, so what the data suggests is that it's not so much an Anchorage versus the rest of Alaska, but what we do see are generally higher patterns of use in rural areas. I don't think that has anything to do with the fact that they're rural communities, but there are risk factors like unemployment and other things that are happening in the social environment that increase the risk for folks using substances. So we do see that in Alaska data, that there are often higher rates in rural communities as a whole. Every community is different, though, and patterns of use vary across the state.
Well, at what age are we starting to see children experiment with substances or alcohol?
Yeah, so earlier than most folks think, and I'm sure we'll get into that today. That's why, as a parent, you want to start having conversations. You know, what I often in my clinical practice will ask parents, what age do you know your child? What age do you think you should start talking to them about these things? And as soon as they give me an answer, I say, okay, you want to start a couple years earlier than that.
Oh, no.
So whenever you think it's time, it's definitely time, because kids are just exposed to things and people are talking to them about things, and you want to make sure that your voice is part of that conversation as a parent, and really open that channel of communication in a non-judgmental way, so that your kids can ask you questions and can talk to you about what's going on. And I like to suggest just a Socratic method. Just ask them questions. What do kids do? What are there kids at your school who do things that are harmful to themselves? And just open that dialogue. So I won't say a particular age, like you need to start at 8 or 10 or 12. I mean, you know your child, but as soon as you think it's time, it's definitely time.
Well, I like what you're saying about asking those questions, because I guess that would help steer the conversation.
Yeah.
So if your child comes back and they say they're talking about playing Pokemon or something, you know, or something dangerous that's really not traditionally dangerous,
yeah,
then that would steer your conversation in a different way than if they're coming back and they're saying things about things that they've heard that may or may not be true.
Yeah.
About medications or even alcohol or vaping. There's so many things out there that they're exposed to.
Yeah, and I think if you use that that just being curious as a parent is such a an effective tool, right? So just, you know, what do other kids at your school do? And just asking questions. And you can do that in a way that's not lectury or judgmental. Like, and kids often, especially in middle school, they know that there's kids in their school that use substances. So just ask them, do you think that helps them? Is it, do those kids seem to do better? Are they achieving their goals? Are they happy? And your child will say, no, they're not. And that's a way of, you know, fostering a dialogue where your child can start to develop their own values that share your values around substances and taking care of their body and achieving their goals. And that is just so much more effective than you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that. Because those messages, kids just kind of, they kind of tune us out when we do that.
That is powerful information, Mr. Robertson. I think we're all going to write that down and use those exact questions at our dinner table tonight. Well, what are some of the factors that are contributing to adolescent substance and alcohol use?
Well, you know, it's interesting in the data. Substance use in the overall population went down a little bit during the pandemic, probably due to some access, you know, that access was a little bit more limited and controlled during that. But some of the factors that we look at are social isolation. You know, as a behavioral health professional, I pay a lot of attention to untreated mental health conditions. When kids are struggling with depression or anxiety, it increases the risk that they'll turn to substances as a really ineffective, but an attempt to try to deal with things that feel overwhelming to them. Those things aren't helpful, but untreated mental health conditions, social isolation, and loneliness all increase risk. So those are some of the things that we look at when we look at preventing substance use in adolescents. And another important factor, I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit, but if we can, the earlier someone starts using substances, particularly in adolescence, because of how the brain is wiring up, the more it creates risk for lifelong use. And that really has to do with the fact that your reward centers, all substances that are addictive, work with the brain's reward system. And the reward system is really wiring up for its lifelong patterns in adolescence. And so if that reward system can wire up around other things that make you feel good, those are the habits that can stick with you. So like you feel good because you just achieve something in sports, or you had a wonderful conversation with your friend, or you went for a nice walk, or you painted a beautiful painting, or those sorts of things. If the brain can wire up around that stimulus for the reward system instead of using substances, it's really protective for the adolescent's entire rest of their life. So
that's very interesting, because I know when we talk about food and teaching healthy eating habits in children, we always talk about not rewarding them with food,
right,
and having them develop other habits and giving them, you know, activities and things that we think are more healthy to reward them for doing something good. Yeah. So, and I guess that all ties into the brain. And I'm wondering if that all ties into the development, how they say our brains aren't developed fully until we're 24 or 25 years old. Well, and I know there are very obvious consequences of, you know, alcohol or substance abuse. What are some of the less obvious or potential risks of our children using these substances in alcohol?
So I'm happy to jump in here. I have some other thoughts too about some of the other questions. Sorry, I didn't just interject. But in terms of some of the things we see, it's really about that behavior change and about not meeting their own goals, which we often think of as one of the best ways to approach a conversation when a person at any age might be struggling with substances, is to really say, are you being who you want to be? Are you achieving what you want to achieve? Are these still the same values that you held a little while ago? But we see, you know, behavior change, whether that means not participating in things they used to really enjoy, maybe not being as social with friends they used to be social with, as well as kind of the other side of that, seeing some behavior acting out and sort of getting in trouble, doing worse in school, just not participating as much.
Yeah, you just shared some of those warning signs that we should look out for. And I think when we're thinking about warning signs, if we don't know what to look for, because I'm sure there are a lot of parents that may come in and say, I had no idea, I didn't know. But if no one has shared with us, what do we look out for in our kids, then how are we going to seek help when we need it? What were the other thoughts that you wanted to share?
Yeah, just along, I support everything that I heard Joshua say, but in terms of talking to your youth and when to start, another thing to keep in mind is that they are starting to see advertisements for alcohol and alcohol use in society around them from a very early age. As soon as you start taking them to restaurants, they're going to start seeing alcohol use and they're going to start hearing about it from their friends. So you don't want to be the last person who talks with them about alcohol. And we know that the more youth see marketing for alcohol, the more they will drink and the worse outcomes they will have from that drinking. Like, it is causal, whether or not that marketing is actually targeted at them or not. So just to remember how prevalent alcohol is in our society, and that as they're going to start seeing it immediately. So might as well start pointing out, oh, like, what do you see in this advertisement? Are they really selling alcohol, or are they, you know, trying to exploit the female body, which a lot of alcohol ads do? You know, like, what are they trying to get you to see in this ad, and what's the reality? Because they're so far removed.
I didn't think about that exposure, because there is so much exposure. And I was thinking more on the lines of marketing that's targeted to kids, but they are hearing, seeing everything. And so the programs that we're watching, or if they're watching adult programming with us, they are going to be bombarded with these advertisements. And advertisements are made for a reason. They're made to get you to participate in something that, you know, may or may not be healthy, but that is the job of an ad to do that. And so that's a very difficult task to shield in some way your children from this. It seems like an impossible task to
right.
me.
So maybe instead of trying to shield, helping them to discern, you know, what's real and what's fake about this. What are they trying to sell to you? They're spending billions of dollars on this. Why? And especially with social media, I mean, alcohol marketing regulations are already controlled by the alcohol industry, so not great. But on social media, that's tenfold. Everything's harder to control on social media. So many times we see influencers or musicians, movie stars getting paid to sell an alcohol brand without having to disclose that it's an ad, or they're supposed to, but they usually don't. So just to really recognize, to help kids recognize what they're seeing.
Well, let's put a pin in that, Ms. Hall, and let's get into social media when we come back from the break. So we are going to take our first break. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or comment for our guests today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion of substance and alcohol use in adolescents with Mr. Joshua Arvidson and Ms. Tiffany Hall as Line One continues statewide.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've got Medicaid, make sure Medicaid has got you too by keeping your contact information up to date. Visit medicaidrenewals.alaska.gov to use the new online form to quickly update your contact information without waiting. A current mailing address, phone number, and email address is needed to avoid delays in healthcare coverage. Plan to stay covered by visiting medicaidrenewals.alaska.gov for information and resources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by guest Ms. Tiffany Hall, who serves on the board of directors for the U.S. Alcohol Policy Alliance and is the executive director of Recover Alaska, and Mr. Joshua Arvidson, a licensed clinical social worker and chief operating officer at Alaska Behavioral Health. We're discussing substance and alcohol use affecting our children and adolescents. Have you had to have the difficult conversation with your children regarding drug and alcohol use? Are your children experiencing peer pressure from online sources? Do you have experience with adolescent behavioral and mental health? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So, Ms. Hall, before the break, you brought up social media, and I want to delve into some of those challenges of social media. And these social media platforms expose our youth to various challenges and trends, and they glorify risky behaviors, creating this false sense of acceptance and normalcy surrounding a very abnormal issue. So what are some of the specific trends that you are aware of that are influencing our youth today?
Well, I am probably not the best person to ask because I try to stay off social media because of what I know it does for my mental health. But I know the one I've heard of most recently is the Benadryl challenge on TikTok, where youth are taking an exorbitant amount of Benadryl in order to try to hallucinate or feel other effects of the drug that way, sometimes with terrible effect. I believe at least one child has died so far. And to me, it's kind of reminiscent of other challenges that we've seen before with the Tide Pod challenge where kids were eating detergent, right? And I remember from my youth, it wasn't on social media, but, you know, trying to hyperventilate in order to feel different in our body. And so to me, so many of these things come back to wanting to feel different in our bodies, which is so often a reason that people end up using substances. And what else we know about alcohol use, or probably all substance use, is that when people are drinking to cope with stress or anxiety or just wanting to change how they feel, we know that that's the most dangerous type of substance use, as opposed to maybe socially at a party isn't quite as risky usually. I mean, doesn't lead as often to a disorder as drinking to cope.
Earlier when we were talking, you brought up the fact that children or, you know, an adolescent, and actually maybe all people should have mental health visits like you do annual exam visits for your general medical problems. Can you tell me more about the importance of having an evaluation and is that even possible for children to have mental health evaluations yearly?
Absolutely. I think it's so critical for all people. It would be great if everyone wanted to get a screening for various mental health disorders every year. And we do have in not all of our schools yet, but many of our schools have access to mental health care. And youth can go for substance use disorders at any time, but if it's for other mental health care, they need permission from their parents. And something that seems really interesting that we're seeing right now is that for maybe the first time, there's less stigma for youth to seek mental health care, but there still is that stigma with parents. And so because parents have to give permission, it's, you know, maybe youth can't access it, or maybe parents aren't even thinking about that. But wouldn't it be wonderful if, just like our routine doctor's visit, we could also go for a routine mental health exam? Because these screenings can catch issues when they're just starting, before any dangerous coping habits have really developed, and maybe before the mental health issue has developed too much. And to get those positive coping tools early on is just one of the best prevention methods we could think about.
Yeah, you brought up the fact that people want to feel different in their bodies. And that is something that I haven't thought about before, But that is something with adults. We know that it's used as coping. And I didn't think that it would be the same for children, that they would use it in this way, mostly because I didn't think they'd understand how certain substances could change. So,
yeah. And adolescents, you know, the brains and their bodies are wired up. I know this is a little hard to hear as a parent, but they're wired up for some risk taking. But what is the risk that is developmentally appropriate, right? Part of why adolescents, we think, are wired up like that is because, you know, there's a big difference between being 12 and 22. You've got to grow a lot. You could be going from elementary school to having your own children in a decade. Wow. You're going to have to take some risks. You're going to have to push yourself. But in terms of the prevention about feeling different and kind of adolescents are really drawn, and it's I won't go into all the neurobiology, but they're really drawn towards behaviors that we would call risky. But those healthy risky behaviors could be trying something you've never done before, pushing yourself, you know, to go to the rock gym and really, you know, in a safe way, but in a way that still helps you feel different, you know, and really feel alive. And those kinds of behaviors are really important in adolescents. And if we can help adolescents steer in those directions to help them feel those things, you know, different in their body, to really feel alive, to feel challenged, that is so protective. And it really is, I think, the key to buffering from this turn to substances in efforts to feel different in your body. As a clinician, that's what I see as creating the risk for adolescents. I agree 100%.
That makes a lot of sense. I think I was definitely more risky in terms of adventurous as a younger person than I am now. Now I don't like to be as adventurous as
Absolutely.
I once did. Yeah. But giving them a challenge,
yeah,
I think that is certainly key. Now, you mentioned Ms. Hall not being on social media. Now, I am on social media, and I have not come across any of these challenges. So I don't know if that's naivete, but how do we stay abreast of what our children are being influenced by?
I think it's a challenge, and it's hard to know. And the way, you know, I think Tiffany spoke to this really, really eloquently, is that marketing and advertising and all these things that are sort of targeted at youth are powerful. And so there are ways we can try to shield, but I really like the term buffer, right? As a parent, you buffer your child's experiences. Some of that can be, I know a lot of parents have pretty sophisticated ways of kind of monitoring or limiting social media use. But another strategy is to really talk to your kids about, there's a couple of things that I think are really important with things like Benadryl challenges and these other things, is there's some things that youth don't understand about substances. One of the myths that youth often hold is that they think that only street drugs are dangerous. And I encourage parents to talk to your youth about everything that you put in your body matters. And actually, pretty much anything can be dangerous in excess. And there really is, you know, the difference between prescription and non-prescription medications, and you know this as a physician, it really is just a regulatory thing. Things that are in your medicine cabinet can be very dangerous if they're not used appropriately with the guidance of the parent and a physician. And so those are important conversations to have with kids because they just don't understand. They think if it's in the medicine cabinet, maybe it's not dangerous. It can be deadly. So that's one myth. The other myth I think that I see a lot in youth, and this is pervasive in social media, is they'll say things like, I hear from adolescents all the time that, oh, you know, I smoke cannabis, but it's safe because it's natural. And I'll say, well, do you smoke cigarettes? And we've made a lot of progress around tobacco use in our country among youth. And they'll say, no, those are dangerous, dirty cancer sticks. And I'll say, you know that tobacco is a plant, and cannabis is a plant. They're both plants. In fact, most toxins in the world and poisons actually do come from a plant. So just because something grows in the ground doesn't mean it's safe for your body. And I'll just say this 100%. Cannabis use is not safe for adolescents. It wires up those reward patterns in the brain that can be very problematic for lifelong use. So those are the kinds of things that your youth is exposed to all kinds of messages. But if those messages aren't coming from safe and trusted adults who kind of know the facts, they really can misunderstand how substances affect the body and be at risk of dangerous behaviors.
A particular challenge must be the availability of these over-the-counter substances. And not only that, but many of the over-the-counter substances used to be prescription only.
That's right.
And are now over-the-counter. So they do have access to not only what's in your medicine cabinet, but some things, aside from cold medicine, I think, they can go in and purchase on their own. And as their independence increases, that's very easy. I mean, you can order it to your home. So there's so much access that's out there, because my question was, how are they getting these substances? There's a study that's done every year at University of Michigan, and they ask children and adolescents questions about, you know, do you think it's difficult to get drugs? No. Do you think all drugs are dangerous? No. They think that these things are readily available, and they don't think they're dangerous. So Mr. Arvidsson, that is super important. And I think sometimes even adults may not know that certain things are dangerous when used in certain ways. And so that may not be part of the conversation.
Yeah. And you often don't know what's in something that you're taking. I mean, that's, a lot of the escalation in overdose deaths among adolescents in the last decade has been associated with opiates. And we think that often they don't know what they're taking. Substances may be laced with fentanyl or something that's potentially very deadly, and you don't know. Those are important conversations to have with youth. You really need to know what you're putting in your body, and it needs to be safe, and it needs to be something that's going to help you. And if you have any ever question about that, you need to talk to your parents about it.
Right. Well, I want to get into fentanyl and the specific substances that the adolescents are using. But we have a caller. We have Kristen from Anchor Point. That's a question about how are we going to pay for all of this. So, Kristen, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you for letting me on.
Yes.
That's pretty much it. I mean, I listen to these shows, and from my point of view, we're talking around in circles, because they say, well, these children, these adolescents, they need to go get treatment. But treatment causes problems. I'm sure your guests there, when they're treating people, want to be paid. I mean, if suddenly the parents can't pay, the state won't pay, the federal government won't pay, I doubt if they're just going to, out of goodness of their heart, keep seeing these people. They're going to say, well, I'm sorry, but we need to be paid. And treatment programs, that needs to be paid for. Places that they can detox, that needs to be paid for. A good hunk of the population can't afford that. And another hunk of the population has sprung up that don't want to pay for it. Mm. Their attitude is, well, it's your child that's all messed up. Why should I pay for them? You know, why should I pay for the adolescents today that's strung out on drugs and not quite all with it, when, you know, that's your problem, that's the parents' problem, maybe that's the other community's problem that they're in.
Right.
And, of course, answer to that is that the screwed-up child of today could be the person who goes into the Safeway tomorrow with an automatic weapon and kills everything that moves. You know, so this does have to be addressed. The money needs to be found. We need to start hearing, okay, we can put together these programs, and this is how much it's going to cost.
Right.
Now, if you want it done, this is how much it's going to cost.
Absolutely. And Kristen, thank you. Let me let them address this, because that is a very important question about how we can pay for this, because this is a community-wide problem, and this affects all of us, whether it's your child or not. So what can we do to provide services and have them covered?
Yeah, so there's a couple pieces I'll say. As a CEO for a behavioral health organization, I think a lot about these issues. And one of the things that sometimes folks don't think about is that Substance use disorders are in treatment for them is often actually part of what's covered under your health insurance, because I think we've made a lot of progress. We are starting to understand that behavioral health is part of healthcare. It is part of healthcare, and so that's the first piece is to not make assumptions about that, and to really look into that. For a lot of folks, insurance will cover behavioral health services. The second piece, and I really do appreciate the caller's comment around cost. My response always is, we will end up paying eventually. The cost of untreated substance use disorders is astronomical. We can provide, I'll just give you an example, we can provide outpatient therapy to 20 to 30 kids for the same cost of incarcerating one adolescent, right, per year. So you're gonna pay. It's sometimes hard to make the argument because the costs are what we call spillover costs. If you don't treat someone and provide the help they need with a behavioral health condition, you're gonna end up as a community paying for it in some way down the road, and often end up paying quite a bit more than if they had been offered the help that they needed up front.
But therein lies the problem, because prevention.
Well, that's what I was just going to comment on. I mean, to that point, if we go even farther upstream, prevention pays 7 to 1 compared with treatment. And that's not even, you know, the cost of after treatment when they're in an emergency department or incarcerated. So really, it's going to take a mind shift of folks who are in charge of money to recognize the value of prevention, to recognize that they may not see that monetary value in their elected term, but that we will over generations, and that it's incredibly important to fund upstream prevention. And we've seen some progress on that. Anchorage now has an alcohol tax, and some of the revenue from that goes to prevention programs. Most recently in the election, the revenue from the marijuana tax will be going to early education and childhood development, which are huge prevention factors. So I am happy to say that we're starting to see some of these shifts, but it will take dedication and continuing that.
So it seems you both seem, you know, hopeful, and that is good. And you're committed in working on advocacy and change. And I like what she said, you know, this is everyone's problem. Mm-hmm. But I think in our society, we really need to value our prevention more. And I like that we're making strides in that way, but even in, you know, in medical care, health care, I mean, that is where we want to put our focus, but often not where the focus is, because you're trying to treat the problems as they arise. Well, let's talk a little about what are the adolescents using? You talked about the Benadryl challenge and over-the-counter. Are there other things that are more prevalent?
Yeah, so we've seen So there's an interesting kind of nationwide analysis of youth risk factors called the YRBS survey, Youth Behavior Risk Factor Surveillance System. And that system looks across the country and then also at what's happening in Alaska. And what we've seen over the past decade is I think it's always important to talk about where we've seen some improvements. Mm-hmm. because we do have to hold on to hope. So we have seen decreases in the use of tobacco products by youth. Now we've seen an increase in vaping, and that's where I think we really have to talk with youth, because there's a misperception that vaping is safe. But we've seen a decrease in tobacco use, and I think that's a big progress. You know, a really interesting thing, as I kind of pour through this data on a regular basis, just because it's so interesting to look at, one of the other areas we've seen progress is one of the specific questions on the Youth Behavior Risk Factor Surveillance System is, have you ridden in a car driven by another young person who's used alcohol? And the number of youth reporting that has consistently declined year over year over the past several years. I think youth are becoming more aware of how dangerous it is to get in a vehicle with one of your 17-year-old friends who's used alcohol. So we've made some improvements in some areas. Areas where we've seen escalation of risk is the prevalence of access to opiates in our community, the presence of very dangerous substances like fentanyl. Again, this goes back to talking with youth. A recent conversation I had with a young person, they said, Do you know what fentanyl was originally developed to do? I'm sure as a doctor, you know. Fentanyl was not intended as a medication for human beings. This is used to like sedate elephants for surgery. And you're putting that in your body. People are putting that in their body and it can kill them. And youth just don't, they don't know that. They have all these terms for things like fentanyl and they don't understand what is actually in that is something that was used to sedate large animals for surgeries. It is not intended to be put in the body of a 14-year-old or really any human being except under very, very, you know, specific certain circumstances. So I think those conversations are really important to have. And those are some of the changes that we've seen in the last decade. And those are important because, you know, as parents, we think about what was happening 30 years ago. Well, that's not exactly what's happening today among young people.
Yeah, I'd love to tack on to that. What we're hearing from youth, I mean, we have also seen in that same surveillance system, we have seen first use of alcohol, regular use of alcohol, and binge drinking of alcohol all decrease significantly over the past 20 years, which is wonderful. And what we're hearing is that now sometimes youth are being sent to college and their parents are like, oh, you know, go have fun, go, you know, assuming that their child wants to party every night because maybe that was their experience. But we're hearing from youth that's not actually what they're interested in. And but there is like some of this interesting, not quite pressure from their parents, but just really different expectations because times have changed so much. We're seeing this generation now drinking far less than any of their kind of counterparts in prior generations. And I just want to highlight, about 1 in 5 youth at traditional high schools in Alaska drink alcohol. That means 4 in 5 are not drinking. And it's so important to flip that narrative and recognize the positives that are happening, especially because in another survey of students, when asked who they think is drinking, they respond that they believe the majority of their peers are drinking, and it's just not the case. But it's so common, especially in adolescence, to want to do what everyone else is doing, that if that's what they believe, then they'll be more inclined to do that, even though that's not the reality. The reality is not many high school students are drinking the way we sometimes assume.
So we need to highlight the fact that the majority of their peers are not drinking alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then maybe even thinking about what we're doing as we're sending these kids off to college. Are we normalizing behaviors that we should not be normalizing?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to take our last break and we'll get more into this when we come back. So let's just take another short break for the stations down the line. If you have a question or comment for our guests today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. We'll continue our discussion on adolescent alcohol and substance use when we return. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've got Medicaid, make sure Medicaid has got you too by keeping your contact information up to date. Visit MedicaidRenewals.alaska.gov to use the new online form to quickly update your contact information without waiting. A current mailing address, phone number, and email address is needed to avoid delays in healthcare coverage. Plan to stay covered by visiting MedicaidRenewals.alaska.gov for information and resources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our guests today are Executive Director of Recover Alaska, Ms. Tiffany Hall, and the founder of the Alaska Child Trauma Center at Alaska Behavioral Health, Mr. Joshua Arvidson. You can also join our conversation. Are you aware of the warning signs that your child is experimenting with drugs and alcohol? Do you need resources to help a child or adult that is experiencing a problem with alcohol or drugs? Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, I definitely want to talk more about the warning signs of substance and alcohol use in our adolescents. What should we be looking out for?
Yeah, so a couple things are, you want to look for dramatic changes in your young person's behavior that signal something significant is going on. It doesn't necessarily mean that that is always a sign of substance use, but it is a sign that you want to be asking questions. How are you doing? What's going on for you? I think Tiffany spoke really eloquently earlier about how patterns of substance use in adolescence often develop out of a want to feel different or to cope or to feel different in our bodies. And so when your young person is really changing their behavior, they're withdrawing from their peers, they're withdrawing from you, huge changes in sleep or huge changes in appetite, these sorts of things are just warning signs that something is going on. It doesn't necessarily mean they've started using substances, but something's going on. And so starting that conversation, how are you doing? What's going on for you? And expressing concern. And that's the most important thing, is concern, not judgment. If you say, you know, those kids who use substances are bad kids or whatever, then what you're really telling your young person is, if you ever use substances, I'm gonna judge you negatively. The reality is, yeah, we're not ambivalent about substance use in adolescence. It is harmful, but we recognize it as a harmful behavior. But there aren't really bad people and bad kids. There's kids that we're worried about and that are using substances in ways that aren't helpful to them. So having those conversations with a young person to try to create an opening so that they can talk to you about what's going on for them. And then as a behavioral health professional, I also have to say, like, when kids are anxious or depressed or those sorts of things, we want to give them help and have, and whether that's professional help or just support in the family, so that they don't turn to substances as a way to cope with those feelings.
Right. Well, good parents have children that use substances, and good children use substances.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's important to state. Mm-hmm.
In addition to reducing stigma, it's not that we're ambivalent about substances, is that we want to support youth no matter what, and we care about them no matter what. And we have problems with the behavior, but the person underneath that behavior, we have to have unconditional positive regard, and that's essential. And judgment, or kind of being preachy to kids or negative to kids, it really just shuts them off from talking to you about what's going on in their life, and that's not helpful.
And then you mentioned just watching how we react to other people having a problem. What are we saying to our children about that?
Yeah.
Because you think, I'm not going to be judgmental when I talk to my child. But if your child sees you being judgmental in other ways, there's a lot of things that we have to watch out for, don't we?
Yeah, but if you just, I mean, it seems complicated, but it's really pretty natural, right? So, like, I was driving in the car with a young person in my life, not as a therapist, but just as a young person in my extended family. And we passed someone, you know, who is standing on the corner of the street, you know, asking for money. And I said, what do you think is going on in his life? What challenges do you think he's facing? What do you think he needs? And really shifting that conversation from, oh, that person has a problem, to that person is really facing some challenges. And yeah, they may be engaging in some behaviors that are destructive or harmful to themselves, but that's a human being. And I hope the best for them. And if we can have those kinds of conversations about, even when our youth, you know, are aware that other children in their school are using substances, those aren't bad kids. Those are kids who are engaging in behavior that's really going to be harmful to them. And we're concerned about them, and we wish the best for them. And so it sounds complicated, but it's really not, right? It's just about having that perspective around substances, that the substance is harmful, but we want the best for everyone.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just to add on to that, I'll just say, when I was active in my addiction, toward the end of it, one of the primary things that kept me from help was the stigma and the shame that I felt, because I was so convinced that I was a terrible person and that things that happened to me while I was intoxicated were happening because I deserved them and because I was a terrible person. And it really, I mean, it's kind of one of the cliches of the program I used to get sober, is that, you know, when I surrounded myself with community who had been there, who had gone through it, who were on the other side, that they really loved me until I learned how to love myself. And even though my family is incredible, very supportive, never had a reason to believe that they wouldn't support me no matter what I told them. But I still didn't want them to know, you know, what I was going through because it just felt so heavy. And so just to say, you know, it's so easy for that stigma to not only impact the person who's struggling, but their loved ones as well. And sometimes parents or spouses or siblings can feel really embarrassed or ashamed and also not want to talk about it because, you know, they feel like it's this failure on somebody. And so to just try to reduce the stigma for everyone around that person as well.
So it's the personal shame. It wasn't that you were feeling shamed by someone.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, that's important to know that when you need help, you realize that you may need help, but that kept you back from that personal feeling. Well, where do people go? Let's say someone else realizes that you need help, or they realize that their adolescent needs help and they've talked to their adolescent. Where do they go from there to solve this problem? How do they get the help that they need for the adolescent?
I'm happy to say folks are able to call Recover Alaska 907-249-6647. We have someone who is a clinician who can talk with people to try to help figure out what the issue might be and just point them toward a couple of different resources around the state. And then I would also say 988 is just a really critical tool for mental health crises, and I think would be a great one for every person to save in their cell phone right now. Just save 988 so that when you're feeling like really in crisis or really stuck and don't know what to do, to reach out to them. And they built a text program specifically for youth if they don't want to call. But then I'm sure also within our referrals, we would eventually get to Alaska Behavioral mm-hmm. Health, especially around youth. So you can go ahead, Joshua.
Yeah. So So sometimes there's a perception in behavioral health that you have to be referred by someone or you have to be referred by your doctor. That can happen. But over half of the folks that we serve at our clinics actually just contact us directly and seek help. And that's a misperception. Like if you want to go see an orthopedic surgeon, yeah, you got to get a referral from your primary care doc. But fortunately in behavioral health, both substance use disorder treatment and mental health treatment, we have direct access just like primary care. So our number is 563-1000, and we have clinics in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and now in Wasilla. And we serve the entire lifespan from 3 to 83. And we'll serve about 1,500 children and youth a year. So we direct folks to all the resources that Tiffany identified as well. Like 988 is a 24-hour crisis line. So you could call them at 2 in the morning and get help directly there as well. So
thank you. So now we know where to go. We are out of time today. Let me give you a few seconds to share your final thoughts. Mr. Arvidsson?
Yeah, so I just I want to echo something Tiffany said earlier, which is we have to shift the way we think about behavioral health care. Behavioral health care is just like primary care. You don't feel sick, you go to your doctor. Not a big deal. If we can think about behavioral health that way for children, youth, and adults, I think we'll make a lot of progress.
That's right.
I think the only thing I would say is just to restate, kind of talk to your children early and often. Don't make it a big deal. They don't have to be your child. It can be a niece or a nephew, someone you coach. But we know trusted adults are a great protective factor. And the more they talk about it with truthful, honest, open adults, the better off they'll be.
Well, I really appreciate you both being with us today to share your insights on this very critical issue. So thank you to our guests, Ms. Tiffany Hall and Mr. Joshua Arvidsson. Thank you to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line 1.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.